following program has been furnished and paid by Nathan P. Ross, CPA, and KSEV is not responsible for its content or the products or services offered.
Welcome to the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, a show that helps you learn how planners can generate significantly more wealth now. Nathan will answer your questions about business or personal finance, or how to increase current cash flows and generate retirement savings to make sure you're on the right path, and so much more. Whatever your financial goal, Nathan can get you there faster. And now, here's your host, Nathan Ross.
Welcome to this week's Be a Planner Tax Smash Show. I am your host, Nathan Ross, Tax CPA, and I also have Dan Dubose, CPA, on the line, I believe. Dan, are you there?
I'm here, Nathan. Thank you.
Excellent. Excellent. And as you know, we start off each show asking, when's the last time your tax pro called with a way to save you money or to create significantly more wealth over the rest of your life? And Dan, what's the response we usually get when we ask that question?
Never.
Well, we get a chuckle or two before we hear those words. But in any event, we are planners, whereas most CPAs tend to be reporters. And so, you know, we approach things a little bit differently. And for that, we're thankful we have the ability to help you plan. And so today, part of what we're going to talk about is why we should have already started on 2022's tax return. And of course, many people haven't even thought about what's going to happen next year when they go to their accountant. Correct, Dan?
Yeah, I'm starting to get some calls. Fortunately, we've got people trained a little better these days, it seems, because we have been planning.
Well,
we've
good.
Been teaching them to plan, and that's what we're trying to talk about today more, is get planning before you have to at the last minute. Just be ahead of it.
Well, you know, we are seeing a little bit of that. Excuse me. However, in large measure, I think tax planning typically only comes into the normal mindset of taxpayers once they find out how much they owe when they're being handed the completed return. So I'm going to look ahead a little bit at this point, say mid-March 2023. Spring is in the air, and you're getting that good feverish feeling. You're in the process of expanding your business or your real estate investments, and already you're starting to get calls from prospects for your real estate units. And your creative marketing is working. You're really psyched up thinking about what a great year is coming. Except, and what's that except, Dan?
Tax returns due.
That's right. You're just as all these good things are happening, it suddenly dawns on you that with only about a month left until April 15th, you must get your taxes done. You and about 120 million other American taxpayers, okay? So you probably at that point, if you're like most, have really not done much preparation, so you have to drop everything, including doing business, making money, which is why we do any of this stuff, and get to your tax preparer ASAP. And I would tell you that most people start scrambling through their records, summarize their checkbooks, dig up bills, receipts, and call up anything you can't find, calling a bank, calling a brokerage company, etc., looking for that 1099, or maybe you bought a property or two this year and you're looking for the HUD-1 settlement statement because you know your accountant's going to be asking for that. And if you can't find stuff, you start putting estimates down, which we as preparers don't like using except as a last resort, and some things you really can't just use an estimate. But anyway, so Dan, what happens when on or about April 1 people show up at the door and now they're saying, hey, here's my data. I need you to prepare my return. So tell me what it's like in your office.
Well, first of all, we going to tell them they're going to have to get in line probably, and they're going to file an extension.
It's not a bad thing. That's actually what I would call a best practice, although some people that do taxes probably would not. But I want to point out to you that the name of the form that we use that the IRS willingly provides us, what's the name? What's the key word in that name, Dan? Do you recall right offhand? We probably never really look at it, but I have it in my memory bank.
Voluntary.
It's the word automatic.
Automatic.
Extension of time to file. Now, what does that tell you about why you might want to consider an extension on April 15th and why, if you're one of our clients, you will extend? We don't file by the due date, or we try not to. There are some good reasons, very few, why you might want to, but there's a lot better reasons as to why you want to go past the initial filing deadline on most any form that you're going to file with IRS. And we're not going to go into it this show, but let's just say relax a little and let's focus on getting some quality data, enough of it to the preparer. Not because they're going to be out golfing if they do what we do with extensions. We're going to be working, but what are we going to be working on, Dan?
Plans.
I'm sorry, what'd you say? Plans?
In
part, but we're going to be working on doing estimates for our clients to find out if they owe or have an overpayment in a material way before we actually click submit on that extension. Because what happens if you owe at that point, Dan? What needs to happen if you owe?
You need to write a check to the IRS.
That's exactly right. Or log on to directpay.gov, I believe is the site, and submit a payment electronically. That's the way I recommend making payments these days.
And the IRS prefers anyway.
Well, that and with the backlog in paper documents, it might be a while before that check gets processed. Although I'll notice they don't seem to have quite the backlog on checks that need to be deposited. Have you noticed that, Dan?
I have noticed.
Seems like they get that part right. Somebody's got time to open the mail. It's just they don't do much with it if there's not a check in there. By the way, I should have already said this, just because you're listening to the show today, don't get any bright ideas about rushing out and implementing any of the strategies we might talk about or start investing in apartments, which we'll refer to here momentarily, or any one of assorted other items that affect your financial wherewithal, your future, etc. Let's let you go consult first with your current advisors, be it tax, legal, real estate mentors, investment advisors, and explain what you thought you heard on the radio and see if it's relevant to what they know about your facts and circumstances. Unless you listen to this show and you're already one of our clients, we don't know what makes up your tax facts and circumstances, and far be it for us to tell you what you should or should not be doing. In any event, so typically, you know, most CPAs, I'm going to pick back up with the harried nature of most accounting offices around April 1st, if not March 1st, maybe even February 1st for those that typically get started the minute the IRS e-file system comes up. But in any event, understand that most preparers are CPAs or accountants who, as Dan said, make their livelihood from other services, including, in our case, planning. We do a lot of planning, and a lot of it is updated in that first quarter for the next year, so that typically takes time, and then we've got clients that are trying to execute their contributions to their 401 trust or maybe a self-directed IRA. We've got a few of those. You know, they're not focused on gathering data as of yet. They're focused on funding the prior year, which, you know, it's kind of a cool thing, at least with the self-directed 401 trust, that we can fund that obligation that we're going to write off. So for 2022, you don't have to fund it necessarily in most cases. Well, in all cases, but there's some reasons you might want to prior to the end of the year, but you don't have to fund it until your extended deadline next year. That's another reason we file extensions. An extended deadline to next year seems to imply, although you'd be amazed how many CPAs don't realize this, it seems to imply that one extended the underlying return for the entity that sponsors the 401 trust. So for those of my clients that fund in September, October, that's because we filed an extension back in March or April, depending on the type of entity, and that gains you another 6 months to actually put the money into the trust bank account. That's a pretty nice perk of that particular retirement plan. But in any event, you know, the with the kind of deadlines, and by the way, the planning services typically have some deadlines, although they're not as, in most cases, hard deadlines, but they are there. And so we got to, you know, be considerate of those deadlines on top of all the filing deadlines. But with all the filing deadlines to meet in March or April, you're prepared. You can just rest assured. Some may hide it better than others. You know, I guess, Dan, you do a pretty good job of that, it seems. But your preparer is pressured, tired, aggravated, and working at least an unhealthy 80 to 90 hours a week, running around like a chicken without a head. And so now you walk in, drop off your shoebox of records in front of this exhausted headless chicken, who replies, "Okay, it's pushing it, but I can have it done by April 15th. How many times have we said that back in our ute, Dan? Before we knew better, right?
Multiple, yes.
That's right, many, many times. So typically, that preparer is going to take your information, confirms a couple items, plugs the info into their computer tax software. The tax software spits out your tax return, which is then processed for you to either pick up or execute the Form 8879 e-file signature form that authorizes us to submit. And off it goes. And on April 15th, your tax return has been finished with nice, neat instructions on how much you owe. I'm going to say it's often a lot, where to sign and where to send it, or again, where to approve, you know, the 8879 form so we can file. You, of course, as a client, tell the preparer that you are upset about owing the government. How many times have we heard that one, Dan?
Every time, I think.
Exactly. Nobody likes paying taxes, and yet everybody has a tolerance for how much work they're going to have to do to avoid doing so. And so we try to give you some balance there. I mean, I'll tell you, there's certain things that I think are, you know, have an immaterial impact on moving the needle, let's say, as to how much you might owe. I don't like wasting time on that type of recommended strategy any more than you do. And I'll just tell you, if we can't move the needle at least twice what we're going to charge you to implement or to identify and possibly implement, depends on which strategy it is, we're not going to take you on as a client, as a planning client, because it doesn't make sense for us to spend a dollar and you save a dollar. Dan, what do we typically shoot for in that cost savings ratio?
Two times the savings.
That's right.
Twice.
That's right. That's right. So if we're going to charge you $10,000, for instance, to put a tax plan in place, we want to know that you're going to save $20,000. And that's in advance. That's not, let's roll the dice and see. We're going to know what the likelihood is. Correct.
And that's not $20,000 one time. That's $20,000 many years coming, we hope.
Well, that's true. It could be one time. If you look at the savings on putting a 401 trust in place, it's significant enough to where it might be, you know, 3-to-1, 4-to-1 in most cases. Or we typically would recommend that you, you know, simply pay the tax on the amount. This would be on very small amounts. Maybe you've got $40,000 or $50,000 in an IRA or 401. Well, typically the tax on that would be at a level that I would suggest, hey, maybe you just go ahead and pay the tax. It's not pleasant, but you know, when you look at the fees that we charge to put these entities and strategies in place, it doesn't make sense. And I don't want to do it. I'm an old guy, Dan, like you, and we've got a limited number of hours left, if you want to think of it that way, to do good. And I want to do good for people that enjoy paying our invoices. And typically the ones that enjoy doing that, or at least don't mind it, I should say, as much, are the ones that are getting that 3- and 4-to-1 benefit. It's like, you know, we're your low-cost option, which is something I say many times as I'm explaining the strategy. So anyway, but the typical preparer, when you hear that complaint, here's what they're going to say. We're sorry. There's nothing we can do about it now. You have to look at this way. Paying taxes is the cost of doing business in the United States. That's kind of what we say. I would suggest to you we explain that, hey, how about you call us after April 15th and let's get some data from you. Most people think just because they give us their tax data to file this year's return that we know everything they have going on, right? We understand which children are going to which college, if any college. We understand that you've got a small business, which we probably do, but what we don't understand is that you have X number of dollars in investment capital available that maybe you might be able to deploy within the context of REPs, you know, real estate private partnerships, which we like so much. Or maybe that you've got, I mean, Dan, I'm just curious, when you get tax return data to do a return, how many people tell you what they have sitting in a 401k at their employer? That doesn't go on any form, does it, to my knowledge?
It does not, but we do try to dig it out because it is an important number for us to know from a overall planning standpoint, I believe.
You know,
I was talking earlier today to a guy about his 401k. He's got about $1 million in it, and he has no dependent noted. I mean, there's a good reason to know what he's got there in a 401k. It's just to make sure he's got his dependent. I'm sorry, his beneficiary noted somewhere within his document. I mean, that's a must. That's an absolute must.
Right, it is. And if you don't have that, if you don't have that, you may get to visit with a probate court at some point.
Right.
That said, every 401 trust that we adopt with our clients comes with designated beneficiary forms, as does the big 401k that you've got at the office. And if you don't review that information at least every other year, maybe more frequent, you may have a change in heart that's not reflected in the beneficiary form. So I'm just going to suggest to you, you know, people change, people age. Those decisions need to be revisited on some frequency, whether it's a year, every 5 years, 2 years, whatever it is. Take a look at those and make sure that those plans from yesteryear still make sense. And so, Dan, what we do, and this is a good time to explain it, is we provide a set of intake forms on the BAPlanner.com website. If you'll go to that site, it's BEAPLA nner.com, and you will see the client profile form. You'll also see a retirement profile form. You'll see an individual tax reporting profile, and then lastly, a business tax profile for those of you that have businesses, whether it's just a side gig or whether it's a, you know, full-blown Yetzy business or a lemonade stand. Doesn't matter to us. If you've got something generating income that needs to be reported that may have some planning opportunities, then, you know, it makes sense to make sure we're aware of it beyond simply the taxable effect that might happen. And so you may be a member of some partnerships. Again, we would expect to see K-1s in your data, but beyond that, we don't really have any idea of what that's about. But in any event, fill out the forms. You can also schedule a call. The link right next to that intake form link at the top right of the website, and we'll take some time to see how we might fit your circumstances and your objectives. And of course, this is after you've checked with your professionals, although I think most tax preparers are what we would call reporters. They're not planners. And answering that question we ask at the top of the show, most accountants, most CPAs, most tax professionals will be the type that are simply reporting what happened a year ago. We would like to affect what happens later on. For those of you that may have just tuned in, I'm here with Dan DuBose, CPA, and today we're talking about why you're paying too much money for taxes, and we're also going to talk about why or how you might want to consider getting started in real estate, specifically multifamily projects. So if you've got any questions and you'd like to see if we can address them possibly real time, send us an email at info@npross.com. That's info@NovemberPapaRomeoOscarSingapore.com. Or you can text us at 713-area-581-0195. And, we're talking about topics that you may have some longer-term questions about. Just feel free anytime. Keep that information, and if you'll send that to me even, you know, during the week, we will gladly take some time to set up a call with you and see how we might be able to assist. Dan, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
No.
Very good. Dan's very brief in his response. He's the voice of reason in most cases. So anyway, okay, so we're going to come back now that we've talked about the headless chicken complex. We're going to come back here momentarily and talk about what is this costing you. Specifics. We're going to tell you the six ways that this approach of approaching your tax preparer in early April is likely costing you if they, in fact, push forward and do a tax return. And we'll come back to that momentarily. But in the meantime, I wanted to address getting started. If you're not already involved with the apartment investment business, I'm going to give you some good reasons, and I'm also going to tell you how not to do it. We're going to talk a little bit about the show that comes on before ours. That's a common expression I use, and almost every week they say the same insane thing about getting started investing with real estate, and specifically these real estate private partnership syndications involving apartments. And I can't believe they keep saying it. I keep correcting them every week, and they don't like it. I've heard from self-made millionaire himself that they do not like me presenting the truth, the alternative. And I'll give you several reasons that they won't give you about how to do it. They simply want to focus on the ways you make money, which I agree is absolutely important. And I agree with their five ways. In fact, and I believe they add a sixth way for investing in multifamily. I haven't bothered to figure out where the sixth one's come from. They've used five for low these last 30 years, I believe, if you believe the start date. And so in any event, I'll talk about those momentarily, but I want to just say something, Dan. What's the single biggest reason any of us should involve or invest in real estate private partnerships? What's the single best reason? Number one on the list. And I'll help you if you're trying to pick. How about cash flow?
Nathan, you broke up for a while there. Did you ask me a question? I'm sorry.
I think I did. I was asking you what's the single best reason to invest in these real estate private partnership syndications. In most cases, I will admit I've invested in transactions that might have a five-year hold before you see much. But generally, what are people looking for when they invest their money in these real estate partnerships? There you go. Cash flow. Cash flow is absolutely the number one reason most of our investors seek passive income producing assets. I'm going to underscore passive and income producing. Okay. And without cash flow, you don't have income, meaning you can't quit your job eventually if that's your goal, and it may or may not be. Doesn't have to be. I disagree with self-made millionaire on that point. To me, the only cubicle that you're running to every day, or prison, as he calls it, is one that you don't enjoy or get gratification from. And I am sorry that he didn't get gratification back in his days when he was selling health club memberships for one of the largest national firms back then, President First Lady, I believe, Bally's. And for some reason, corporate America didn't treat him well. And that's fine. I understand that. You know, I left corporate America myself. Dan, you left corporate America and went and started our own businesses, and just like he did. But that doesn't mean that I think you're to be looked down upon or you're somehow less intelligent, et cetera, if you gain satisfaction, not to mention a pretty good cash flow out of that job. Nothing wrong with that. However, for those of you that say again, Dan, I'm sorry.
Exactly. I was just emphasizing there's nothing wrong with that when you have that satisfaction that comes with it as well.
Right. And you may decide you want the satisfaction that comes from that, plus you want all these benefits of investing passively. That, to me, is like, having the cake and the icing. And far be it for someone that doesn't know your details or knows how you tick to tell you otherwise. But anyway, enough of that. Let's just say that there's five ways we generally are going to make money in these transactions. The first one is cash flow. The second one is equity capture. This occurs when we're able to buy whether it's a single family rental or a apartment building, we're going to pay less than what it's, quote, worth. And, of course, value is often in the eyes of the beholder. But there's still some math involved. And realistically, if you're buying apartments, or let's say you're buying a home where the comparative sales value of a similarly constructed, it's in similar physical condition, does not have significant deferred maintenance. In other words, it's like the comps that you have there in the neighborhood of what's sold in the last few weeks or months. You somehow have figured out, or you've found a property that's selling for less. So you snag it. So let's say you're buying a home that would be $100,000 elsewhere in the neighborhood, and for whatever reason, you're getting it for $50,000. Now, with that dramatic of an example, it's probably going to be because it's beat up, and it's going to need not just some TLC, but from but some money out of pocket, right, Dan? People tend to forget about that little detail. But let's assume you can fix that property up to make it comparable to the $100,000 property for maybe $20,000, and you're all in at $70,000. Well, Dan, how much is the equity capture in that transaction, theoretically?
Well, theoretically, $30,000. If it's only worth $100,000 when you buy it for $50,000, put $70,000 in it. Put total of $70,000 in it. You've got a $30,000 equity right now.
That's exactly right. And if I wanted to log in to my broker or to whatever site I use and buy Apple stock today, I have no idea what Apple closed at on Friday or what it's actually going for in after-hours trading. But I don't see a way to buy some battered Apple shares necessarily. They're on the NYSE or NASDAQ, whichever one they're on. I'm not a stock investor, so I couldn't tell you. But can't do that in the market. Can't find those equity capture opportunities unless maybe you don't think Tim Cook and the other executives at Apple ever have a way of knowing when the market might go up. Do you, Dan? Think that ever happens? Let's just say that while we're not privy that's the issue. We are not privy to what Apple's got up their sleeve. Those guys are, and it makes you wonder how much of that goes on. And don't tell me it doesn't, but, you know, we know we shouldn't be talking about that. But in any event, without having some equity, and this is the problem with the stock market in general, you're exposed to the risk of a falling market. You're exposed in real estate. It's just that if you've got a $30,000 cushion, you know, how many times, Dan, have we, even in Houston, even in the mid-80s, well, that may not be a great example, but there were neighborhoods that did not go down by 50%. 30% may have been the edge. I know I was living in a home out in North Houston at that point that I can remember had about a 25% adjustment in value per HCAD that I didn't even ask for. Didn't have to appeal the valuation. It was just in 1 year they knocked it down 25%. And I'm sure that happened all across the neighborhoods in Houston. But in any event, so, you know, we can compare this to other options. You know, a Mary Kay cosmetics business, an eBay business, other online businesses, network marketing, vending, car washes, they can all be a significant source of cash flow, but they typically don't offer an opportunity to buy an asset for less than it's worth. The car wash may be the exception there, depending on the facts and circumstances, but that's primarily because it's got real estate involved. Okay, so number three way to or the reasons we want to invest in real estate, the way it makes us money, is market appreciation. Dan, how many times have we seen real estate double in value over our lifetime? You remember the metric, how many years typically it doubles every so many years? What's that number, if you recall?
I don't know the exact number, but I just wish I'd have bought it when I was 10 years old.
Well, there you go, because it doubles in value typically every 20 years. Might fluctuate in the short term, but it's going to rise over the long term if for no other reason the combined pressures and market stresses of inflation and the cost of building materials, labor, and scarcity of land. I mean, that's just three I can think of. I guess it also translates to the fact that you could have more people moving into an area, say like Austin now, where the cost of getting a new home has gone off the charts. You're competing. You've got competition among other buyers. That's a big reason. In fact, that may be the reason why the market appreciates, Dan. Why is it anything more than supply and demand in most cases?
Yeah, you know, when you spend, spending $2 or $3 billion on an investment in a community, you're going to kind of drive up the prices of things in that area, that general area. And that's what Tesla did there in Austin. It just really move that market big time, I believe. That's a part of it. And then all the stuff that comes with that.
Well, if it wasn't Tesla and Google and Apple and assorted other companies that feed the tech industry. I mean, I can remember 10, 15 years ago saying many times that, you know, Austin, I understand why all the UT grads want to live there. The problem is, do they want to work at Best Buy? Because that's your options, right, back then. Well, now look at the six-figure plus bonuses that get paid, signing bonuses. It's crazy. It's the best of all worlds. But what I want to point out is the competition from other buyers was driving those prices up in Austin and elsewhere even before we heard the word inflation a year ago or whenever it first started, I think is about a year ago. You know, back when the administration and the, including Secretary of the Treasury, Janet Yellen, I can't hardly say her name any more than she can predict the economy, right? It's like we were told, oh, all this inflation is transitory. Well, even before all that, the average home price in Houston, San Antonio, Austin, et cetera, Dallas, was moving up. And so the cost of building materials, labor, and scarcity of land, et cetera, that was almost an afterthought in that process. Right, Dan? So, you know, you've got the more people you have vying for a product, whether it's toothpaste or housing, it's going to drive the prices up. And what do you think's happened in the apartment arena, Dan? You're aware because we talk about these deals every Sunday, by the way, 7 a.m. right here on KSEV, the voice of Texas, the Be a Planner Syndication Mass Show. Join us tomorrow and we'll be talking about another transaction or two, but we've been talking about the top line rental growth and whether or not the assumptions that are being used in these pro forma projections is copacetic given what we see happening. And it appears to date it has been. You know, we're seeing 20-25% top-line rental growth projections over the first, I don't know, Dan, correct me if I'm wrong, but typically 2 to 3 years. And we think that's fast, and it may be fast. Depends on how heavy the lift is to get a property renovated. But the reality is, if you're on the other side, you're the tenant. Look at the article that was in the Houston Chronicle last week where they pretty much confirmed that's what tenants are seeing on the other side of this equation. And if you think that a syndication sponsor, lead partner, et cetera, is going to go spend $10,000 a door after they buy the property to put the wood-like, quote-unquote, flooring in, the bark park, covered parking perhaps, a studio room or audio or entertainment room for the property to enjoy watching Netflix and other movie sources, and they're going to put in the very common one these days is the smart home package. If you think they're going to do all that and keep your rent the same, I got another thing coming for you. Isn't going to happen. So, you know, you're basically recycling the tenant group at that point, and you're trying to attract tenants that used to might not have considered your property because it wasn't up to snuff with other properties in the area. So anyway, market appreciation. So thus far we've got cash flow, equity capture, market appreciation, and now again I'm going to remind you, if you're just joining, I'm here with Dan DuBose, CPA, our voice of reason, as I like to say. He's very, I'll use the word, kind word, mature, very mature individual with a lot of years experience. And so, Dan, number four, and this is kind of an easy one, but people forget, who's paying the mortgage every month?
Your
effectively.
Tenant.
That's exactly right. Because, boy, if you don't have a tenant, and I've often said the worst thing that can happen with a piece of, well, I'm going to say with a piece of real estate, I'm especially going to say with a rental property, the worst thing that can happen is that it sits empty. And I had I have a client who used to be one of Houston's heavyweights of Houston commercial real estate, according to the Houston Business Journal. And he made the comment at one point and has said it many times, there's nothing that makes a piece of real estate look better than a rent-paying tenant occupying it. And boy, have I seen that over the years, right? Things happen when you don't have people. And I'll tell you things that don't happen. One thing is you got nobody sending you that check every month that you can turn around and pay your lender. And that's something that unfortunately just has to happen. And if it doesn't, you've got to go through the process to evict that tenant. And unfortunately, many justice of the peace courts that I've seen don't understand that concept. And I'll never forget having a property that I had to evict a tenant out of in San Antonio at one point. And the judge was new to the JP court and was using the expression as I was waiting my turn in line. He kept trying to delay everything 2 weeks. It's like, can't we all just get along here? And how about we take a couple weeks and come back and see what we can work out? And so I was prepared. And when I got to the front of the list and he started down that can't we just get along nonsense, I said, Your Honor, I flew 10,000 miles to get back here for today's hearing, and I do not want to delay for 2 weeks. I've delayed for 3 months now, which was my mistake. This was a long-term tenant. He just started acting fickle, I guess you might say, about paying rent. And I said, no, I'm not willing to delay. I tell you what I will do, though. I won't move to the writ of possession phase, which is where you actually have the county sheriff's office go take them physically out of the home if they're still in it. I said, I'll give him 2 weeks to get me the money. And you and I both know it's not going to happen, but I'll do it. And so fortunately, I was able to get him to agree. But bottom line, without the principal pay down, if you really think the property you're buying is going to be hard to rent, which it shouldn't be, you should check the property out, do enough due diligence to know what the rental market's like in an area before you buy. But without principal pay down, I would question, unless, again, I mean, there are circumstances. You may be buying the Taj Mahal for $10,000. I don't know. And actually, this home I was talking about in eviction court, Dan, we paid $8,000 for that home on the east side of San Antonio. It was a little 2-1 and put about maybe 10 in it and rented it for $500 or more a month for quite a few years. Those deals aren't around anymore. And so, no. I guess I'm walking down memory lane. But bottom line. Okay, you might be able to take a few months. We had very few months, thankfully, and that home was paid off so fast just based on normal competitive or comparative rents. Okay, so number five, Dan, and this is where you are well-versed. What's the fifth reason that we like buying real estate versus a car wash or other trade or business?
You get some write-off.
That's exactly right. The tax advantages. Who pays the lowest taxes of any for-profit group under the current U.S. tax code?
Real estate investor owners.
That's exactly right. The IRS allows us to reduce even our earned income or cash flow, depending on our status as perhaps a real estate professional investor, by taking a depreciation deduction against the house. That's just one of several. When's the last time you were able, to deduct your insurance on your residence or your water bill, your light bill? Keep going down the list, Dan. Internet connections?
Repairs.
I know I'm missing. Yeah, repairs. Oh, I got a good one. How about your homeowner association dues? Never have been able to deduct that stuff, right? And, yeah, you hit on a good one, repairs. Well, guess what? We get all of that with rental real estate within certain limitations, again, depending on your status as to whether you're a real estate professional, and that's a whole other show. And we will do a show on that. We haven't done one to date, Dan, that I can recall. And that would be a good topic to dig in for the 52 minutes, roughly, that we have. But in any event, and then to top off, after we've deducted everything, we can defer or avoid. I'm going to say defer, for most people it's correct, by selling using a 1031. That's an IRC, Internal Revenue Code Section 1031 tax exchange, which means we typically won't pay any tax. You can pay tax on a 1031 exchange, correct, Dan, if we don't do a few things right?
Yeah, you got to, it's very technical. You got to follow all the rules to have it totally tax-free. But most of the time right. You can do it. You just follow the
can't
rules.
Can't take any money out, right?
It's one no payment. Cash out, yeah.
And the level of debt is another consideration, correct, on the go-forward? Anyway, how long can you avoid taxes with a 1031? And this is the cool part, at least for now. If you pass the property to your children, they will take over at the new cost basis, which wipes out all of the capital gains that you've deferred over the life of that asset. And Dan, define new cost basis of that asset.
You're talking about the step up in basis at death. When one dies, the basis is in that real estate that any asset that you own is stepped up, and meaning it comes up to the value, the fair market value at the date of death. It's a hard number that is determined by appraisal, by comparability, by opinion. So
that's true. And let's be clear, it's not just available for properties that you own on your own. It's also available if we use the correct entity type for you to invest your monies into these real estate private partnerships for your family. You will get step up in basis. We talked a little bit about that, I think, a week or two ago when we talked about the reason to use certain types of LLCs versus S-Corps. Correct, Dan?
Yes.
Okay.
Not S-Corps.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, LLCs specifically.
Or LLC generally, yes.
Yeah. So let's go back now to why you're paying too much in taxes, and let us tell you what the reasons are, and then obviously we're suggesting there's a better way. Six wealth destroyers, Dan. Number one is missed deductions, permanent loss. Think of it as spoilage of tax savings. It's in most cases, now there's a few exceptions, it's hard to get them back once we've filed the return or once you've gotten into the new year. Number two, you've overlooked tax reduction planning opportunities that if we were sitting out here like we are now before the end of the year, we might be able to do it. You're also more prone to certain IRS tax traps, which there's several, all of which could be a show in and of themselves. You're more susceptible to IRS inquiries or full-blown audits, the quota for audits is stacked towards those that file by the initial deadline. For those of you that have businesses where you're having to stop and put all this information together, we've got a loss of earnings because your business is interrupted. And then I'm going to say number six applies to both you as a taxpayer client as well as the tax pros involved. Stress and anxiety, which in turn can cause us or you to be less productive as you gather your data. You're not working on business, and as we're trying to work you into whatever crack we have to get things done. And I would suggest dollar-wise, what kind of dollar do you put on all the above? And, of course, it all depends on the individual situation. It can be anywhere from hundreds to many thousands of dollars, and each one of these has a cost. Let's talk about just briefly, because we're running out of time here, the missed deductions and permanent losses in terms of the number one on the list, permanent loss of tax savings. I know in my case, and Dan, you've probably seen bigger numbers as a former We did a lot of small business work back in the day. The small businesses we work on now tend to be client-driven based on planning strategies, so they're a little bit different. But I've seen self-employed entrepreneurs that have overlooked, I'm going to say, $50,000 to $100,000 on a current year tax return. Now, you know, these are companies that were probably generating $2 to $3 million in gross revenues, but let's just say it's easily $50,000 to $100,000 with regard to some strategies. Is that a good range, Dan, or do you take issue with that? You think it ought to be higher, maybe? I don't know.
No, it's a good estimate, but, you know, you're talking about that, you know, when you get up into to that $2 or $3 million revenue stage, yeah, for sure.
You know, Go ahead.
You know, it just comes back to planning again, you know, and knowing what is deductible, what might be allowable for any event that might happen. It's important to look out to the future. I mean, it just comes back to a plan, Nathan. It just comes down to it. Just be organized and have a plan.
That's true, and you know, I saw, I don't know how many times I saw a business owner go out and buy a new piece of equipment in January.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, you know, on a $200,000 lathe, or, you know, I forget some of the things that some of our clients used to buy. You know, if you buy that before year end, and if you're profitable, you can write that whole thing off. We saw a lot of people run out and do that with an automobile. Why wouldn't you do that with a piece of income producing, or with an income producing asset, right? And those guys are typically in the 40% tax bracket individually, and so it equates to a lot of money. So, any event, yeah. Second item, the overlooked tax reduction planning. I'm just going to tell you what Dan did. You know, we got to get ahead of it, take a look and see what are the ways that we can defer taxes by either accelerating deductions, postponing income, et cetera. And, you know, Section 179 first year expensing, I just mentioned, is still a big one. And I mentioned being able to fund a self-directed 401 trust up until September or October the following year. These are the things that we need to look at. And in many cases, it's a now scenario. It's not a January, February, or March scenario. Dan, we've run out of time again. It's hard to believe. I say this every week. I guess it shouldn't be hard to believe, but it still is. Just how fast it all gets here. But anyway, thanks for joining us, and we look forward to starting again tomorrow morning, 7 a.m. Central Standard Time, where we're going to talk about syndication math, and we'll delve in perhaps a little bit more on why you should invest in apartments. Now's a great time. We'll talk to you then. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks for listening to Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. Be sure to tune in next Saturday at 5 for another edition of Be a Planner Show here on AM 700 KSEB.